WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina. This is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. John Baer married Betsy Ross of Concord, North Carolina in 1992. He had no idea then that he would lose her to a deadly virus during a worldwide pandemic 28 years later. He chronicled his wife's COVID-19 battle in an essay published by CNN. John Baer studied journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill after his wife urged him to return to school in 1995. It was there he earned his PhD. He wrote a chapter for a 1998 book titled Assessing Public Journalism, in which he examines the belief systems of journalists. Baer later worked as a media consultant for projects at U.S. News & World Report, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and the Omaha World Herald. He moved to the nonprofit sector when he went to work for the James L. Knight Foundation and later joined the Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation in Atlanta, where he's currently a senior vice president. After his wife passed in September of 2020, Baer continued his work on his first novel, Fair-Skinned Brunette with the Porcelain Shine, a murder mystery published by Wisdom House Books in early 2021. Set in Chapel Hill, author John Baer describes the book as a love story to the town he called home during the mid-1980s and 90s. He joins me now. John Baer, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's great to be in Wilmington.
Well, it's great to have you with us. You and your wife tested positive for COVID-19 in August of 2020. Tell us about the day you learned you had the coronavirus.
Like a lot of people who have chronic disease, what's now referred to as underlying conditions, it's kind of a sterile term that means you are already experiencing a lot of illness. We had to choose between going to the doctor for her routine care and physical therapy and exposure to COVID. So like a lot of people, she was already struggling with health because COVID meant it was harder to go to the doctor. And some of the doctors required COVID tests. So she had had, I think, 5 negative COVID tests. And she was going to see the pulmonologist, which is an important doctor we all know now. They require a COVID test, and she had had these series of negatives. She went to get what we thought would be another negative, and we think she probably got COVID at one of the tests because she wasn't really going anywhere else. So it was a surprise, not that, you know, we knew the world was had COVID, but she had had these series of negatives, and then boom, there was a positive. And I texted her one of her doctors who was available to us by cell and text for certain, you know, kind of things that were emergencies, and they wrote back, yes, she's positive. So we...
Had she been having COVID symptoms at that point?
No, she actually, this is part of what's challenging for a whole lot of Americans. You're at greater risk when you have chronic illness. So she had been admitted to the hospital for a blood infection, which was scary enough. And everyone says, stay out of the hospital, stay out of the hospital. And they were going to do another COVID test. And I said, well, she just had 3 recently. And the one last Thursday was negative. Well, the one last Thursday, we think, because she went to an open medical clinic to get it, it wasn't a drive-through test, was probably where she got COVID. So she was already admitted in the hospital with a... being treated, hoping to avoid sepsis for a blood infection when the COVID positive test came in. I then went and got a test and was positive, and her home caregiver was tested and was positive. So the 3 of us were all positive at the same moment.
And it meant different things for the 2 of you. You've said that, and I'm not asking you to go into her whole complicated medical history. Certainly, but a lot of that's private, but you have said that she fought multiple chronic diseases, experienced constant pain from deteriorating discs, and twice dealt with breast cancer.
Yeah, she was the toughest person I've ever been around, had the highest pain tolerance, things that are not fatal but are painful, like kidney stones, she suffered. And the asthma and the diabetes were bad to have in the world where COVID is a threat. And what was so hard about, well, there were lots of things hard about it. One was I was quarantined and not well and could not see her. No one could go see her. Her daughter couldn't see her. So we were trying to talk by phone and stay in touch. And initially the doctors said, this is a mild case. She's doing fine. We'll send her home in 3 or 4 days. There's a complicated part of that we can talk more about if you want. But what ultimately happened is one day she was in the category of this is a mild case, she'll be fine, called the next day, and she was in ICU. So there was a period overnight, more or less overnight, where it attacked her lungs. And, you know, a lot of us have had someone in our lives with pneumonia, and it's treated with antibiotics. It's a bacterial. COVID pneumonia is, they call it that, but it's really where this virus takes over your lungs. And she never recovered from that.
And you write in this essay that you produced for CNN that she was working so hard to breathe, the doctors were providing support short of the ventilator. Why initially no ventilator?
She had made a decision just in her life. She'd been very thoughtful about how she wanted to pass and had, over the years, had different instructions. And as we age, those instructions get edited a bit. And she said, I don't want to be on the ventilator. And that we were supportive of that. We understood why. She was on at least two different versions of breathing machines. The conversational language is CPAP, and I think the other one may have been called BiPAP. I don't know the technical terms. And she was rolled over to be on her stomach, and when we would talk, she would say, I'm trying so hard. I'm trying so hard. So it was, you know, if I asked you to carry boxes of books to the basement and it was up and down steps, you would have to try. But we don't usually have to try to breathe. It's what we would call an involuntary response, whether, I don't know if, what the doctors call it. But she was thinking all day long, I've got to breathe, I've got to try. And each breath was a struggle. And then the reason she agreed to go on the ventilator for a period of time was she was able to join a test, an experiment with antibodies. And the antibodies were available, but for her to get them, she had been on the other machines long enough that weren't working. They were going to have to try the ventilator, and that would buy us some time to see if the antibodies would help turn it around, and they didn't.
At one point, you thought she was recovering, and she actually came home.
Yeah, that was both the frightening, unsettling, you know, every kind of nightmare thing you can have, because I was pushing the doctors. You know, I would get a call from the county health department on a recorded line saying, you've tested positive for COVID. You cannot leave your house. And the hospital was calling me to say, come pick up your wife. And I kept saying, you know, I can't. You've got around-the-clock nurses, people to change the bed, clean up. I'm one guy, and I have COVID, and you're going to send her home. And her infectious disease doc said, you know, I would feel comfortable in day 10 if they said it wasn't bad, but in day 3 and 4, it's too early. When she came home, we had the little oximeter that a lot of people have come to know. You put on your finger, and her blood, her oxygen was about 88. And about that time, the person from the hospital called in what they call virtual care, telehealth, to say, we want to check on Miss Bear. We just discharged her. How is she doing? And I said, well, her oxygen is 88. And the woman shrieked and said, she should be in the hospital. And I said, you just sent her home. And the EMS guys that brought her home, since I wasn't allowed to go get her, EMS guys filled that function, and they were gentle and wonderful. They were still there, actually, and they arranged to take her back. And that was the next morning. She was, instead of saying, oh, we got it all worked out, the next morning was she's in critical care and may not make it.
Yeah.
So went from good enough to go home to on her deathbed in 12 hours.
Yeah. And you decided at one point with her, she decided to go on the ventilator. And you knew that if she did that, You could lose her.
That was a hard conversation, as you would imagine. I mean, the hardest conversation I've ever had in my life. You can't rehearse it. It was by phone. I couldn't see her and her daughter and I and her doctor. Her doctor was in the room and her daughter and I were on the phone discussing these options. And the option for not going on the ventilator is to die because the other breathing machines were no longer working. They couldn't, she couldn't contribute whatever percentage, you know, they said we're having to supply 10% of her oxygen or 40% of her oxygen. I'm not good at the technical piece, but the machines were having to do all the work. So they no longer worked. And so you get to that point, and I think I wrote, the nurse from palliative care calls and says, this is likely what's going to happen. And she said, if you're, and I asked, you know, do people that go on the ventilator ever come off of it? And the nurses in the room are heroes and cheerleaders and angels. The palliative care nurse was very honest and said, not very often. You know, it's actually something we celebrate in the hospital when it happens because it isn't routine. Mm-hmm. So we knew that was going to be the last conversation we ever had, most likely. And it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is a good time for a break. So we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll perhaps hear about this conversation that you had and why you thought this was important to share with the world. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with John Baer, Senior VP of the Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation, and now a novelist, among other creative exploits. We'll be back from this short break in 90 seconds. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. My guest today, John Baer, is a senior vice president at the Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation by day. By night, he makes slices of ceramic pie, photographs it, writes fiction and song lyrics. He lost his wife of 28 years to COVID-19 in 2020. And John, just before we went to break, you were talking about the experience of having Betsy in the hospital and the decision to have her go on a ventilator as sort of a last resort, knowing that she may well not come off the ventilator. And you had what you knew could be your last conversation with her over the phone. Can you tell us about some of that conversation?
Yeah, I wrote about that. I didn't write about what we said, and that's, you know, in between us, but I would say it's pretty much what you would imagine in some ways. In some ways, it feels harder than, there's not kind of an adjective to describe it because the finality of last is last. You know, where there's no control, alt, delete, there's no undo, there's no this is it. And we had talked enough about illness over the years that I want to say no one would ever be prepared for that moment. But I think we both thought about what we would say. And one of the reasons that sort of the grief comes out in emotion is not sadness. I was very lucky to get a last conversation.
So many people don't know that they're having the last
conversation. Well, in the 600,000 people that have passed from COVID, they may have passed in a rest home, may have passed in a hospital with no visitors, may have passed unexpectedly. It is an incredible gift to get that. And so the grief comes out, and it all looks the same, whether it's sadness or whether you're remembering a joyful moment. But it is, you know, if you sort of count the three luckiest things in my life, that's the luckiest, is to get a last conversation.
Yeah.
We were very fortunate for that, blessed.
Yeah. You write about how people around you often try to comfort you. And you write, "We hold our tongues and nod as acquaintances suggest certain fixes, from yoga to Pilates to forest bathing." What would you really like for people to ask about or say to you in a circumstance like that? Should they avoid asking at all? What would foster the most comfort and connection for you?
So it is a tough item because the flip easy answer, there's nothing to say. For old friends, is to talk about the same things we talked about before. I've met a lot of people who are suffering through grief. And one of the women I've met is a social entrepreneur. And she's starting a platform, I guess you call it today, that would allow people who are grieving to post things they need, almost like a registry. And people who want to help then can more accurately say, oh, well, they need their yard mowed or their trash pulled down to the curb or food or something like that. I'll say the thing that, and I'm not good at this. I'm learning through my own experience how to be helpful to people. And before Betsy passed, if you had asked me, John, are you good in situations like this? I would have said, no, I don't know what to say. And so I approached it with great humility and a lot of uncertainty. Rachel, how can I help you? What can I do? I've talked to people who have similar reactions who are in grief. That's now my assignment. Now you've given me a job to figure out how you could help me.
Asking the person who's grieving to do the work.
Yeah, and as opposed to sort of a random act of kindness. And you start to see the difference between, and the words are all comforting. They really are, and especially in a world in COVID where you can't hug people, the words are special. But people that just take an action and do it. Talking to a woman who's a very good friend, she reached out to me now because she's in a period of grief. And she was mentioning something. She's got two little girls that her daughter wanted. And the next day her friend had gone to the store to get it. And that 15-minute errand when you're in grief is impossible to do. And it forever has changed the relationship between these two friends. So acts of kindness, however small, are good. And I had a friend who was on the West Coast, and she would call and talk to me about everything that was happening that day and never ask about Betsy. We just chatted. The people who
have... And that was comforting.
It was fun to talk to an old friend.
Yeah.
And to hear what was happening in her life and what was something interesting on TV, or she'd tell me about a book she read. People who have lost spouses, I realized I joined this kind of secret club that no one wants to be in. And even people that were not dear old friends, but professional acquaintances or that kind of category when you're adult, you don't know quite what to call them because you didn't know them when you were growing up, but they're not just somebody you've met. They all reach out, still reach out with uncanny timeliness. And you can ask them questions that you can't ask other people. So that's a pretty amazing little network.
You know, you write about this very personal, traumatic experience of loss. And there's a reason that you did this. And it was more charitable than it was. You know, this wasn't about you. This was at the suggestion of somebody else. What is it like to have this story about your wife out there in such a public way? And what do you think it does?
Well, everyone processes, this is one of the cliches that is true. Everyone processes this differently. Throughout my life, I tend to write about things to get through them. Many times you write about it and file it away because it was only for your therapy. My older sister, who is a wonderful writer, had encouraged me to write and said, are you going to write something? And I really was honest and said, I don't think the world needs another pandemic article. That's all that's out there now. But one day I had a thing in my head that, you know, all of the statistics aren't explaining the human, damage and loss and grief here, and I want to get this out. And I had been talking to a doctor, and I sent it to her. It was self-therapy, so it was sort of, at the beginning, self-indulgent. It was part of my grieving process. And she said, this is good. You should share it with other people. It should be published. It will help people. I tested that with a couple of other people whose opinions I trusted, and they all agreed. CNN has a wonderful editors at CNN.com, so they tightened it, made it a little more relevant to the general public. And I would say the feeling, to answer your question directly, is relief that once you've said it once out there, I can sort of say, hey, read the article. I don't have to keep saying it. I haven't ever done that to anybody, but it is, having gotten it out is, you know, if you imagine detoxifying a period of your life, it feels like that. It feels like you're getting toxins out.
Yeah. And you're noticing, you've said, the unpredictable nature of grief. You wrote, now I cry in the car and I cry in the grocery store, at work, on the phone, in my doctor's office. I have cried writing, painting, sculpting, sending emails, and pruning shrubs. I have cried in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Massachusetts, and Montana. And when we spoke for the first time on the phone, you cried and you were candid about the unpredictability of the waves of grief. So how would you describe its behavior now?
It does make some people uncomfortable, which I'm sorry about. I don't intend for it to make people uncomfortable. But the first question I asked my doctor, I think the very first question, when we got on telemedicine at the time doing some, just some counseling, I said, I understand from hearing pop culture there are waves of grief. Stages of grief. What are the stages? And she shook her head and said, there are no stages. It's not linear. No two people experience the same. And it comes in waves. And you can't be responsible for the waves. They just come to you. So accept them and you can't do anything. And I like to be let off the hook. And I think, okay, it's not something to manage or process, but it just comes and fully experience it. Don't try to, metaphorically bottle it up or hide it. So it does. It sometimes comes at inconvenient times if you're in a professional setting, but it often comes at a song lyric, a mention of a TV show, drive by a house that Betsy used to point to and like.
What TV show were you just thinking of?
Not a particular one, but Betsy would provide a running commentary of what she liked and didn't like. She didn't have much of a filter in public, much less in private. So anything from CNN to the Today Show, she was a loyal viewer, but highly critical. And she watched all of the mysteries that come out of the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Australia. So we had a whole collection of mysteries she exposed me to, and she would have favorites and this or that. And right now, when I watch TV now, it's silent. There's no running commentary. So those things that nobody tells you, the obvious things or the big things, you kind of get geared up and get ready for. Her birthday came and went, and because you anticipated it wasn't such a big deal. But menu items will just tear you up.
Yeah. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with John Baer, Senior Vice President for the Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation, author of the novel Fair-Skinned Brunette with the Porcelain Shine, and the song lyrics, which begin each chapter. So let's talk about this murder mystery that you actually started when Betsy was still alive, and she was one of the champions, as I understand it, of you completing this work.
Betsy had really high expectations for the world. It was easy to break her heart for that reason, because she held herself and her colleagues and her family and friends to high standards. So she fully expected me not to write a book, but to write five books and to just get on with it. What's taking so long? And so I'd been working on this character for a while and had in my head a character named Lassiter James, which opens the wonderful nickname Lassie. So Lassie James is my protagonist that isn't, I anticipate, appear in a series of books. And I'd always written and noodled around with song lyrics. So I had Lassie be sort of a part-time songwriter, not good enough that that's what he does for a living. But on the side, he writes some songs. And I don't write music or play an instrument, so my personal contribution are lyrics. That part of the character caught an attention of a friend, Don Dixon, who's a highly accomplished music producer, a musician himself. And he said, you know, these are interesting. I think we can do something with these. And I, at that, you know, having been given an inch, I asked for a mile and said, you know, let's do an album. And he said, well, that's complicated. And we said, well, let's go slow. So instead of rushing into it, I said, maybe we can get 12 songs done over a year and then get in the studio. And that's more or less what happened. Don came up with a plan, recruited these amazing musicians, and we went in the studio in a really kind of amazing, famous place in Kernersville, North Carolina, the Fidelitorium. So Betsy was, you know, with me and with us when the music was finished and was a fan of the music. She played it a lot. And that's a special moment.
Yeah. So let's listen to this title track, Fair Skinned Brunette. And then I have a couple of questions about this.
Sure.
There is a fair-skinned brunette. She plants in the spring. She wears a big hat to keep her cheeks soft. Her shoulders get red in the Halifax sun. She appears in my dreams when angels carry me off. She hangs her jeans on her hips and sheets on the line. That fair-skinned brunette with a porcelain shine.
And that is the title track from the new novel, Fair-skinned Brunette with the Porcelain Shine, written by John Baer, my guest today. You're listening to Coastline. John Baer, who or what inspired the fair-skinned brunette? Who is she?
Who is she? I should say, Don Dixon is co-writer of the songs with me, and that's Jeffrey Dean Foster's voice who brings Lassie James to life. The fair-skinned brunette with the porcelain shine is, in fact, a collection of people. It isn't inspired by any one person. I imagined and am interested in the story of this woman who is, in my mind, dependent on no one. And that's sort of the salient point may or may not come across in the song. But she has these interesting characteristics, everything from, you know, listening to Tammy Wynette to making her own paints and things like that. But she's a fiercely independent woman, and the lover in the song who's seeking her is competing for her attention.
And in the book, the novel, which is a murder mystery, the fair-skinned brunette is Dr. Holly Pike.
Yes.
Also known as Fats.
Yes. Yeah. And she pulls off the nickname. Not the easiest one to pull off, but she's a compelling, kind of intimidating inventor, Fortune 500 leader, a billionaire. If Elon Musk were a woman, maybe he would be Dr. Holly Pike. And she's, this is her moment. She's on everything from the cover of Time magazine to running sophisticated research trials as her products help improve the quality of life and help improve the condition around the world. So she's a global scientist and is back in Chapel Hill for to receive an award and reconnects with Lassie.
Yeah, and this is after how many years? What, just briefly set the stage for this, why this was such a big reconnection.
This is about 30 years after they've seen each other. So as young undergraduates with the world in front of them. And
they were a couple.
They were a couple. They were bulletproof and engaged and ready to be married. And when she went out to go get biscuits one morning, she never came back. And you know, at last he has realized, probably for the benefit of them both, because they both went on to great careers, but it broke his heart 30 years ago, and he's not over that yet.
Yeah. And you are Lassie James? I know that's not fair.
I would aspire to be in a lot of ways, but I think Lassie's like a lot of UNC alumni who can't resist moving back.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with John Baer, author of Fair-Skinned Brunette with the Porcelain Shine. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. John Baer published his first novel, Fair-Skinned Brunette with the Porcelain Shine, in early 2021, just a few months after his wife became one of the more than 600,000 victims of COVID-19 in the U.S. He works now as a senior VP of the Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation in Atlanta. And he is a prolific creative. He is a photographer. He also writes song lyrics, some of which begin each chapter in his book, A Murder Mystery Set in Chapel Hill. He also creates ceramic slices of pie and stunning oyster shells, but we'll get to those in a little while. John Baer, you were telling us just before we went to break about how the book, the mystery launches. Fats comes back to Chapel Hill after having walked out the door for biscuits 30 years ago, leaving Lassie James, her fiancé at the time, behind. And he hasn't seen her since, but she's become the Elon Musk of the pharmaceutical industry, if Elon Musk were also a supermodel and, you know, genius in so many other ways. So she went to get biscuits. Where was she going, and why are the biscuits so important?
So I did a reading before the book was published in 2019, thinking we were going to be doing a lot of these live events. And Don Dixon played some songs, and I read from the book. And when I read it out loud, I said to the audience, this actually sounds like a novel about biscuits more than a mystery novel. And those of you that have been through Chapel Hill know Chapel Hill's a pretty good biscuit town, and Lassie James is a bit of a biscuit expert. And Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen is the go-to biscuit source for him, with the late night biscuits coming from Time Out. But Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen is sort of daily fuel.
And that's a real place.
It is a wonderful real place on East Franklin Street. And we've been in such a difficult moment in history that some of the, quote, real places are now gone. his beloved restaurant that was so important to the community, Crook's Corner, is gone. Yeah. Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen is both real and still making biscuits every day. And Lassie's girlfriend had gone on a biscuit errand and 30 years ago and not come back. And his life, you know, Lassie's had a wonderful career in journalism, the journalism industry being not what it used to be. And with those cutbacks, he found himself back in Chapel Hill finishing a PhD. And Fats has gone on, as you said, to be a billionaire success story in the pharmaceutical industry. But your first love that breaks your heart always is a heartbreak to deal with. And Lassie is shocked and surprised to have her back in his life as she reappears in Chapel Hill. And not only reappears to get an award from the university, but to hire him to solve a mystery associated with some threats of corporate fraud in her pharmaceutical business.
And the murder mystery is, it's the murder of UNC Chancellor Sanders Millett. He's the guy selected to lead the university out of the dark ages, or the dark years, the pall,
yes,
from the athletic academic scandal, which is real. The university was,
yes,
put on probation by its accrediting agency for bringing in athletes and not giving them an education, but exploiting them and for their athletic ability. I mean, this was an international story. Why did you decide to include that very real complication?
It was probably more, as they say, write what you know. I didn't overthink it. It was you write what you know. And for me, the Chapel Hill is a character in the book. So there's Lassiter, there's Fats, there's Siler, who owns a bar, and a couple of other people. But then there's the town of Chapel Hill, and the town I treated as a character, as a person in the book. And you write what you know, and leadership is the defining characteristic within an institution. So I picked that moment of a new leader coming in, and to make it interesting, you know, the line that Elmore Leonard supposedly said when they said, "What's the secret to your writing style to make it interesting?" He said, "I leave out the boring parts." And so I tried very hard to leave out the boring parts. It's an easy read. I tried to create some urgency to it, the way it reads. So you're experiencing the urgency that Lassie feels with a woman that broke his heart reentering his life, and now one of his close friends being murdered, which creates stress and tension in your life. And he's ends up like the people we see in the TV shows and movies who are not policemen, but that solve crimes. He solves the crime.
Yeah. And it is a fun read. It's a compelling read. I really enjoyed it.
I probably
lost a few hours of sleep staying up to finish
it.
It's
good. It's good.
It's a thriller.
You can enjoy a biscuit while you read. And
I know so much about the tantalizing nature of biscuits now, like the globules of cheese and, you know, all the different, like there had to be several there. And there was a cinnamon bun and the bacon, egg and cheese. And then was chicken involved at some point? There's so many biscuits.
Yeah. Chicken biscuits are part of your a smart young person's daily routine. And the cinnamon rolls are the added treat for now and again, but they're important. They're important parts of everyday life in Chapel Hill.
So much of this, I mean, you've called it a love letter to Chapel Hill and UNC, but there's this really brief mention of Silent Sam, the Confederate monument that was pulled down in 2018 by protesters.
Yeah.
Has your thinking on Silent Sam evolved since you attended UNC versus today?
Well, I didn't overthink that one. I thought it was time for the statue to go, and I could give more than one reason. There's, you know, it's one of those things that if you do the pros and cons, in my mind, it didn't represent what the university should be today and tomorrow. And we don't want to create hostile environments for people. And so it fails to me the test on a modern understanding of race and hate. It fails the test on the lore around it for gender. And its undergraduate is 60% women. And it's the hood ornament of the university. And if, you know, the question that I would ask friends is, in 150 years, is that the best thing the university's done? Send young men off to the Civil War. Is that what we want on our magazine cover? If it had been located at the time in the cemetery, I might have had a different point of view. I don't know, but it certainly didn't belong where it was stationed. And I didn't write in depth about it because I don't have the capacity. That's another book by a smarter person than I would write, and it would have been more than a tangent. But did refer to that part of campus because the murder happens not far from there.
I just want to read chapter 37.
Okay.
It says, "I don't know what happened in that great big bed. I couldn't see a thing." Then chapter 38 begins. So that's the only chapter that you treated that way. And this is after a threesome that you don't go. I wouldn't call this erotic fiction in the sense that it doesn't get that graphic. But that made me laugh out loud, that just turning the page and seeing that was the chapter, because that's the only place in the book you did that. Can you talk about?
I will answer, but I'm curious now to ask you, when you turned the page, what did you think was going to be next?
I thought we were going to go into another scene.
Okay.
I thought the end was the scene in the hotel room, and now we're going to move on to something else because that, you know, the book just moves that way. Yeah. And so the little commentary, that just made me laugh out loud.
So the characters to me are fun, and, you know, it's my first novel. I have no expertise in this, but I like everybody else who sat down to write fiction, you live and die with the characters you create. If they're not interesting to you, why put out the effort? And so I've created people that to me are interesting, and they start making decisions that take them down roads that I didn't necessarily plan. And Lassie ends up on a trip with Fats and one of Fats's lovers, and they end up in this scene in chapter 36. That I thought needed a reference, but without the detail, I would rather leave the reader to imagine whatever they imagine. And so it was partly a literary device and partly the writer's limitations, my limitations, to transition from chapter 36 to 38. And it was intended to be what it actually is, and that you just leave it unsaid as opposed to overwriting. Yeah. So but you're not the first person to ask about that. I did a reading the other night for a book club, and the very first question from a woman who's a former school teacher said, "Will you read chapter 37 and talk about it?" So I guess now I'm going to live with chapter 37. So
Yes, and soon you'll have it memorized.
Yeah. Nobody's asked about 36, though. They all ask about 37.
The scene in the hotel room.
Yeah.
Throughout the book, there's a running joke. Different characters ask, you know, Lassie James is a songwriter, writes song lyrics. And different characters say, I'm not so interested in that song. But is it true that you wrote a song called "She's a Baptist and a Communist"?
I did. I mentioned that to a friend one time. We were in a little tavern in Georgia, and the guy whispered, "I don't think you can talk about that here." So I've realized that among certain audiences, to say the word "she's a Baptist and a Communist" is causing trouble. That said, it's a fun song. Don created a beautiful arrangement, and it comes out of the... I met a woman years ago who is a community organizer by her living. And she was telling me her life history. And she said, "I was born in New Jersey and grew up a Baptist. Then I became a communist." And I thought, well, can't you be both? It didn't occur to me the way she told the story that she would have to make a choice. And then having met many, many strong women over the years who might have fit that a version of that category, thought that needed a song.
Well, let's just listen to a little bit of that.
Weekend. She's the feminist I want to kiss, a Baptist and a communist. a shave above her knee. Wears a scarf she stole in Newport and a ring from Galilee. She's a Baptist and a communist. Shot a man when he raised his fist. She's the feminist I want to kiss. A Baptist and a communist.
She's a Baptist and a communist, one of the songs from the album Fair Skin Brunette, which goes along with the novel written by John Baer, Fair Skin Brunette with the Porcelain Shine. And he is my guest today. You're listening to Coastline. You are this prolific creative. You are a photographer as well. You brought in this beautiful clay and acrylic piece that looks like an oyster shell. It's shades of purple and blue and white, and I'm not sure if that's fuchsia or magenta, but it's stunning. And you also create ceramic pieces of pie and photograph those. Why do you make time for those things when you're such a serious corporate business person?
You know, I've gotten the question more than once, partly because during the pandemic, I think a lot of our hobbies revealed themselves and they might have otherwise been quiet. And in the piece I'd written about my wife, the discussion of the pie and the ceramics was part of that grieving process. My answer is actually a little different than any brilliant insight into why, other than that when I recall being a 5 or 6 year old kid, or when I'm around kids, I was recently with a family whose 7 year old was with us, or 8 year old. They move pretty freely. The kids do, from one day doing pottery to the next day painting to the next day writing a book. And I think for some reason the adults stop doing that. So I don't think it's anything special that I undertake it, other than tapping into the capacity and the willingness and flexibility we all had when we were 5. And somehow we're coached out of that and thinking, oh, you can't put your hands in clay and get all messy. You know, it's going to get all over the carpet or something. But the 7 or 8 year old, it's perfectly fine for them to do it. So I was a creative as a kid. I put some things away in the years when I was working, and then one day thought, well, why did I stop taking photographs? I need to get back to that. It's fun. So the answer is it's fun.
And fun. It's such an important part of life. And perhaps, I mean, I've wondered recently if fun should even be the driver of more things and not just relegated to the category of recreation or relaxation.
I've learned through both just my personal experience and some things I do in my job and other things that there's an entire set of specialists out there, some in the world of economics, believe it or not, also psychologists, who study pretty aggressively what brings us happiness and joy. And one of the things that drives it is to have purpose and meaning. We all need purpose and meaning. But some people gain happiness and joy through creating things. And it isn't so much the reaction of the audiences, that's always nice. It's purely the creative creating. And so taking a stack of clay or taking photographs of something is part of a creative process that is, to me, kind of like fuel. It is what brings me joy.
The book is Fair-Skinned Brunette with the Porcelain Shine, and there are some places, local bookstores, this is available?
Yeah, it's in the distribution system, and I know a lot of folks have been ordering books, whether it's on the shelf or not. I know in Wilmington, it's a great city for local independent bookstores with Pomegranate Books, McAllister, the old bookshop on Front Street. And it's available through the websites that people know about. But the local independent bookstores are such an important part of a healthy, strong community. And they've suffered, like all retailers, during the pandemic. And we want to help them come back to life. And so I hope people will turn there first. There's a bookstore in Raleigh, Quail Ridge, that's been promoting it and carrying it, and we're grateful for all of that.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Once again, the book Fair Skin Brunette with a Porcelain Shine, published by Wisdom House. Author John Baer, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and you can find out how to buy it at johnbaerbooks.com.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered this episode and reminded us of biscuits. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or find it on Spotify, Stitcher, or iTunes. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.